Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Well, we got more Moshe. I think you found the first part pretty interesting, and it really gets even more interesting. And then we got the news, as we like to do around here. First, we got Geico. Geico, baby. Do you own? Do you rent? Well, you do one of those things, right? Why not bundle the policies? Get your auto and your renter's insurance or your homeowner's insurance and bundle it with Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle your renter's insurance along with your auto policy. A good thing, too, because you already have so much to do around the house. Why not take care of it with Geico at Geico.com? Geico. It's easy. Visit Geico.com today.
Adam Carolla is unprepared all winter long.
Will Kimmel get Adam again on stage in free ball? Totally unprepared with no material at all. He's gonna go.
He's gonna go.
He doesn't know.
Doesn't know.
What the hell he's gonna say until you tell him so.
He's gonna go.
He's gonna go.
He doesn't know.
Doesn't know.
Until you give him an idea.
Written out a ball. Get your tickets for the show.
Don't miss Adam Carolla is Unprepared. Aces in Cleveland, Ohio at Hilarities on February 27th and Indianapolis at Helium on February 28th and 29th. And at Helium in St. Louis on April 10th and 11th. Get prepared for Adam Carolla is Unprepared by getting your tickets now at adamcarolla.com.
Yeah, let's explore intrusive and progressive, because I had a grandma that was like your mom, and she used to like to talk about things and rim jobs.
Your grandma talked rim jobs?
She wanted to know if we'd all heard of what a rim job was.
Did she hear about it and say, I heard about this crazy new thing? Or is she like, oh, in the 40s, this is what I used to do. Did you guys do it too?
She'd heard about it, wanted to know if we'd heard about it. And she used to do a lot of those things to us. And I realized she thought she was being kind of cool grandma and on the vanguard, but she was really just freaking everyone out who was around her.
My grandma was the same way, actually. So it's like it didn't fall far from the tree in my family. My grandma, this is a true story. My grandmother, she divorced my grandfather as well, and there was a lot of abuse in that family. And she never could speak about my grandfather without going white with rage. She fucking hated him. Till the day she died, she hated him.
Was he in the scene?
Was he around?
On the scene, yeah.
He died when I was like six or something.
So my grandmother left her abusive husband early and hated her dad and hated her brother. And it was all a lot of the same, like sort of hated males, I guess.
It was like multi-generational. I say in my act, I go, the messaging in my house was like, all men are shit, except you boys. You're good kids.
Right.
Like, okay. So my grandma, she never said one positive thing about my grandfather till the day she died, except when she noticed I started hooking up with girls, and because I had such a permissive household and family, I was bringing them home a lot while I was living with my mom. And so my grandma started to notice that I was bringing girls around, and she cornered me one day and was like, I've noticed that you're bringing women around. I just hope that you're satisfying those women. You know, your grandfather would make me climax every... I was like, shut the fuck up, grandma.
Oh.
I have to live with that visceral memory for the rest of my life. But that it was the same deal with my grandma, my mom. And
let me ask you about that for a second. My grandmother famously showed me grandpa and her water-soluble lube once.
I relate so much to this.
After he died. It's like, everything, everywhere I look, it reminds me of your grandfather's overcoat, his typewriter, the lube, like holding up the lube.
Was it special grandma lube? Was it like butterscotch flavored, or was it just like straight down the middle?
It tasted like ribbon candy. I've experienced this. I have a buddy, Ray, who does this. My grandmother would do this. I know some guys who do this. You tell me if this makes sense to you. Some people do it intentionally to control the conversation. Like, I'm going to get everyone on their heels. I'm going to say something outlandish, and I'm going to get everyone kind of in a retreat mode, and then I'm going to start dictating policy and whatever to them.
You're saying they're throwing like almost like a social progressive bombs and saying catch up if you can.
It's a way of kind of dominating an exchange, I guess it would be. Like I'd have, like, I'll put it to you this way. Like, I had a buddy, Ray, that would just always do it. Like, if you had a zit, he'd come up and go, hey, you got a zit. Where'd you get that zit? How'd you get that? And you didn't go, fuck you. You went, oh, is it that noticeable? And I could see it from across the street. And the next thing you know, he was, like, dominating the conversation. Like, he was the top.
Right.
And you were the bottom of the conversation. And I realized my grandmother would kind of do that, a little shock and awe.
Well, the problem with that for me is that I can't suss out... What parts of it are what you're saying was just social engineering? What parts of it are just deaf culture? Because another thing to know about deaf people, and I'm going to say all of them, they are so blunt. They will literally, if you walk in and you look fat, they'll be like, you're fat now. Why? You know, that's right. Like, that is just the way that they are. And so there was always that kind of like unbelievable bluntness in my family.
So that's pervasive.
Yeah, everywhere. I mean, I was saying, like, my mom would sit my brother and I down every Tuesday night and read to us from a book called Boys and Sex. Mm-hmm. And she, every time she would ask us if we were gay. Like, we got the, if there was such a thing as being too accepting of homosexuality, my mom had that.
This is mind numbing because my mom, like, and grandma wished I was gay.
No, that's how you felt. You feel like, I would be like, still a no, mom. And we didn't even get the impression that it was like she suspected something. Yet, like you're saying, she was hoping.
Well, I think at the base of this is some kind of narcissism where it's like you get to claim intersectional woke points, at least.
Well, this is way pre-woke.
No, I know, but what I'm saying is my grandmother knew a guy named Harry Hay. And he was considered the, you know, Harriet Tubman of the gay movement or whatever. It's like a founding father of the gay movement. And she'd have cocktail parties and invite Harry. And Harry would show up in a dress, you know, at like 83 years old. And she would go like, they tried to hold him down. And he was thrown out of school and his parents turned their back on him. And he's a dear friend. And it was like, it was really you just sort of sounding from the mountaintops how good and progressive and accepting and whatever you were. We didn't call them intersectional woke points.
Sure.
But they've been around a lot longer than 2017.
But, you know, I think my response to it was maybe different than your. I mean, I don't know.
At the time, I was like, oh, there's a super angry guy in a dress.
Sure.
And I bought in. Like, oh, grandma's a hero. Like, back when everyone was,
oh, it's literally him.
Everyone was shunning him, she accepted him. But it's not like he was a delight. He was a douche and angry.
Yeah.
She just wanted the points.
I hear what you're saying.
I don't think she knew it.
Right. I guess my response to all of it, and where did you grow up?
North Hollywood.
Okay, so you're from California, too. I don't know. For me, it was like, in the end, in retrospect, yes, it was mortifying when I was young, but I feel like grateful for it because, like, I don't feel shocked by anything. I feel like I would rather have been raised in a buffet, being force fed this weirdness, than to have been raised on a starvation diet where I, you know, like in some sort of parochial, like sort of by the numbers, you know, this is what's right, this is what's proper. I'm grateful for it in retrospect, but I could see not the opposite.
No, I'm grateful for nothing, which was what I got. Like, I get to make my own decisions and my own religious ideas, and I wasn't spoon-fed anything. I always think about those guys where you go, what do you do? And they go, I do outdoor signage. And I go, what did your dad do? Well, he started the company, and and it's like, did you want to do outdoor signage?
Right,
like,
right.
I have the luxury of a dad who never cared, doesn't know, and wasn't going to help.
So you had to create your own destiny.
But I know I'm doing exactly what I want to do.
Right.
Because there was no influences. And obviously religion can do that, and there's many things that can do that.
Of course.
You know? And you and I sort of have the luxury of no one told us to do this or not do that. And I was just exposed to a lot of different things. And I was like, this seems like a good idea. And that seems like a bad idea.
Right.
I'll treat it like a gin rummy hand.
Well, yeah, like I'm taking my daughter to gymnastics right now. She's almost two and it's like the cutest thing, but it's not serious. And I'm trying to understand what it would be like to be one of these parents that's like, I'm putting her in gymnastics now because I have a vision of her in teen gymnastics when she's 15 and then she's going to the Olympics. And because I got nothing like that. I got full acceptance, we'll love you no matter what, but no guidance.
I'm fond of saying all roads lead to narcissism. And yeah. I just think, like, if you need to live through your kid, there's something wrong.
Right.
And they are an individual and they're not you. And your job is to sort of be there and provide and keep them safe and do a whole bunch of things. But you're not really there to live through them.
I totally agree. But I just compared to what I grew up with, which was that there was no information. There was only love. That was the only thing, which is a lot. But right. my brother had this realization in therapy he talked about where he realized, like, we would come to my mom and we would say, like, hey, you know, you stole our money, or hey, where's the food? And she would say, I love you. And we'd be like, that's the wrong answer. That doesn't apply here. Love's not going to help this.
Did your mom hide behind that?
For sure. She would do something unacceptable and uncool, and then her response to us calling her on it would be, I love you. It's like, well, great. Where's my shit?
Yeah, because I've always said that. Like, I was watching the Kevin Hart special on Netflix, and of course his dad rolls back into the picture after Kevin gets a number of billboards up on Sunset Strip, and then he's like, my boys, I know, they know I love them. Like, that was, and it's like, they don't even know who you are, man.
Right.
They don't know you.
Right.
And they go, yeah, but I love them, and they know they love me, and I know they love, and it's like, okay, so what is love? Okay, so you don't know them, you have no part in their life, and they have no respect for you, but okay, they love you.
Yeah.
What's that worth?
I don't know, but it comes back to that first conversation about sex, is like, I like, there are so many people out there who didn't even get that love part. You know, and I didn't get
that either. I got nothing.
Yeah, I'm not talking about like a fake love, but she genuinely infused our household with love, and like comparing being gavaged progressive sexuality and mores as opposed to like my friends who were raised in this kind of like religious sexual starvation diet. The way their sexualities get warped and twisted, sure. I would rather have my warped and twisted, I guess, than that.
Well,
and the love too.
You know, whenever you try to control, you know, the way to get an eating disorder is to just keep telling someone they're too fat or whatever, right. Whatever. And it always, there is no shaping and molding from the backseat of the adolescent car. It always turns out to be a mess. It's always a mess.
And, right.
You can't create energy around food.
Right.
You know, like my mom would go, hell food, hell food, hell food, hell food. And the second I got to someone else's house that had some Honey Nut Cheerios, I'd go bananas.
We're the same. That was the same thing in my family, too. We had the grossest hippie lunches.
Right.
These, like, disgusting, thick nut wheat breads with only crunchy peanut butter on it.
Unblanched, unsalted, raw peanut. Like, you'd try to spread it on the bread, it would roll.
Oh, yeah. And then they had this, like, horrifying bastardization of the fruit roll-up called fruit leather. Did you get that? It was like...
Yeah. Everything was horrible.
And then you'd go to a rich friend's house.
Right.
And they'd have Capri Suns and Fruit Loops, and you would be like, oh, I'm in heaven. I'm literally in heaven. I am going to get diabetes. And my dad's house was like that. He had all kinds of like kosher candy. So when I would go home to visit him, when he finally won visitation rights, that was like a kind of candy mecca.
So what happens...
Although Jews don't like to say mecca.
What you need to do is... have conversations with your kids about what's healthy and what's not healthy. Don't create a bunch of weird energy around it.
Right.
Don't make it its own religion. If you see the kid, catch a kid beating off, don't swat him with the sports page.
Right.
He's going to be fucking raping somebody in 4 years if you do that.
No, it's like you can't do anything to ensure your kid will not be fucked up, but you can guarantee they will be fucked up. It's definitely possible to ruin them. It's not possible to save them.
Right. And whatever your good intentions are, your mom, my mom, talking about, you know, how fast food is poison and soda's poison and sweet breakfast cereal is worse than the box it's in. You'd be better off it. All that does is make us want to have some fucking honeycomb. And in the honeycomb hideout when you're not around.
You ever seen an ex-Mormon drink?
Oh,
it's no joke.
Look, I was in Utah 2 months ago, and I was like, a lot of really super aggressive piercings and tattoos.
Absolutely.
In Utah.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, these people are breaking out, and now they're pushing back.
Right. It's like Santa Cruz is like this town of punk rock kids. The people my age are all punks. And it's like, well, why is everybody a punk here? It's like, oh, because everybody's parents were hippies. Like, what could you do? How do you give your parents the finger more hard than to go punk?
Right. So the whole thing with everything is whenever you find yourself pushing back against something that was basically created when you were nine, take a look at it.
Right,
because
right.
It may not be inspired by something that's happening today. It may just trigger you. And there's so much of that, obviously.
I mean, I think the older I get, the more I think all anybody is a product of some trauma that they never focused on. And they built a wall around that, and then a wall around the wall, and then a wall around the wall around the wall. And then they're 40 and they're like an asshole. You're like, why am I an asshole? It's like, well, there was just one incident that you could have just focused on.
I'm laughing about food because I was playing a show in Chicago last weekend, and we were out at a really good steakhouse. What steakhouse were we at, Chris?
We're at Gibson's.
We're at Gibson's, right? And when we're done with, we went out after the show. It was like midnight. We had like a 6:30 meet in the lobby and blah, blah, blah. And there's a couple nice pieces of meat left over. And we're like, well, we're all stuffed. What are we going to do? And I'm like, that's coming home.
Uh-huh.
And everyone's like, how's it coming home? It's like, well, we're going to put it in a bag. And then I'm packing it in my bag.
Oh, you flew with the meat.
I fucking flew with the meat. It's in my fucking fridge right now. And I'm fucking eating that shit because I don't throw away meat. And it's not a money thing.
All right.
A food thing. It's
sure.
Like a waste food thing.
Yeah, you become like a feral kid all of a sudden again. Like,
right.
The meat is mine.
People who grow up with steaks and didn't give a shit would not pack up 4 ounces of beef from Chicago, put it in their carry-on bag, and truck it back to L.A. But
yeah,
definitely did.
That's very funny. Yeah, I mean, so basically, when my dad won visitation rights to see me, we would go back. This is where the story gets really wonky. And we would sort of get put in slacks and a dress shirt, get taken to a Hasidic Jewish hair-cutting place. He would give us the closest approximation to a shtetl haircut he could give us from our California bowl cuts. Mm-hmm. And we would pretend to be Hasidic Jews for 6 weeks a year. And so that was the speaking of pendulum swings,
right.
I was like an Oakland public school secular kid, full on just regular California kid. And my summer vacation, I was spent literally in a Yiddish speaking neighborhood where the dodgeball games were between the ultra orthodox kids and the really religious kids. So that was the dichotomy. It was like the ultra orthodox kids were like, those were the wild secular kids compared to the
right.
You know, I was learning Hebrew from the local rabbi who took a shine to me. He was nice, and he decided he would teach me Hebrew. I didn't even know Hebrew. Like a Reform Jewish kid that you grew up with in North Hollywood knew more about Judaism than I did, and yet I was inside of this fiddler on the roof world. I didn't even know the alphabet, and he was teaching me the alphabet, and I was really embarrassed. I was because I couldn't get it. I just couldn't figure it out. And he goes, "Don't be embarrassed. Hold on, Schleipel or whatever his kid's name was." He's like, "Come in here." He goes, "Say, do the alphabet in English." And this is like a 9-year-old boy in America. He's born in America, and the kid looks. He goes, "A B G D Z." Like he didn't even know the alphabet. And
wow.
And these are the kids. Like he didn't. I bet he didn't know who the Yankees were. And he's like living in Brooklyn.
I've seen it here on Fairfax, and I've actually went into a very Hasidic temple or whatever and saw the guys with the boxes on their heads and the food in their beard and all that kind of stuff. And
food in their beard.
They're
just transporting meat.
I was hanging around. I know. I should judge.
Yeah, yeah. They've got a nice steak in there they're bringing home.
I started to look at all these guys as an atheist, and I'm like, it seems like I've also kind of I look at religions like, what's the Rastafarian religion? Well, we get to smoke weed all day and fuck whoever we want.
Right.
And it's like, oh, who came up with that one? A dude who wanted to smoke weed all day and fuck everybody.
Sure.
Like, oh, OK, let's see. I'm going to come up with religion. I get to do podcasts and drive Paul Newman race cars and then watch SportsCenter. Like, it seemed wildly convenient that all these guys weren't working during the day.
Uh-huh.
We're like hanging around and eating all day with a bunch of other dudes. And it was like, women, they can't drive and they have to do what we tell them to do.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, that sounds incredibly convenient, but it sounds like a male who didn't.
Well, sure.
Who came up with this idea because he wanted to fuck people or smoke pot or not work during the day. Like, it all sounds a little too convenient to me.
But then again, I mean, Hasidic Judaism to me doesn't seem like the dream of every man. It seems like it seems like you're born into a tradition of a thousand years ago. And I'm not talking about like the people that you meet who, you know, I'm sure you've interacted with a lot of Orthodox Jews being in the entertainment industry over the years. Like the people that are really hardcore, like my family, they were born into a world where, I mean, they don't, it's not even about like, oh, I like this religion because it does this for me. It's like, it's so far beyond that. It's not like, you know, you go, well, I'm an atheist. Think logically. It's like way beyond that. They're so deep in there. I remember I was in my father's hospital room when he was sick. There's like a rule when a Orthodox Jew is dying where there has to be like a chaperone. So like the son isn't good enough because I wasn't religious. There has to be a kind of sheriff, a Jewish sheriff in there to make sure that when it dies, there's all these purity laws that are followed. And my cousin, he was in there and he a distant cousin, and he goes, can I tell you? He goes, can I tell you a secret? And I was like, okay. What's up? He goes, you're not religious, right? He couldn't believe. I'm probably the only non-religious person he ever spoken to outside of business context in his life. I go, yeah, not really. He goes, I have to tell you something I've never told anyone. And I'm like, oh, you're gay. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Come to the right guy. You know, right. I was raised in the progressive buffet.
I'll send Nana in.
Yeah.
Some literature.
I've got a dress for you that Nana's friend loved. And he looks behind both shoulders and he goes, I've always wanted to be. I'm like, gay, you're gay. You're gay. I'm okay. It's okay. And he goes, a lawyer.
Wow.
That was his deep, dark secret.
Lamenting.
Exactly.
That he can never be a lawyer.
He's so far beyond what even you think of when you think of Judaism. It's like, it's such a deeper, crazy cave of ancientness.
Well, in your mind, and I would see the guys going up and down Fairfax and the 8-year-old boys dressed in black, you know, just from a pure pedestrian standpoint, if I feel like it's child abuse, kids all black running across the street at night.
It's a hot reality, too.
But what... at what point does it cross into abuse?
Well,
the kid doesn't have a say in this world, and they're not going to be able to, probably not going to ever escape this world.
Abuse, it's hard to make for me to make the judgment of abuse because, you know, who's to say that the secular world is somehow a good, superior, fun life? Either. I mean, there's. It's like, do I look at a tribe in Africa? I look at much more like a deep tribe in Africa. When I look at my Hasidic family,
right.
I think of them as like a very rural tribe in Africa or the steppes of East Asia. Than I do. I can't apply my cultural reality to where they are. Are there parts of Hasidic Judaism that I personally find anathema? Definitely, for sure, and that I'd like to see done away with. Yeah, but do I? Can I look at that and say no one should live like that? God, I don't know. It's not that much better on the other
side.
No,
it isn't. It isn't. And my family is an atheist fucking piece of shit mess. But what I'm saying is at least I got to decide what road I would travel down.
Sure.
You know, it wasn't preordained, you know, and I feel like as a parent, kind of the number one thing you want to do is like, look, what you want to do, I want you to be really good at it, and I want it to be something, and I want you to go out and pursue that with great passion and vigor.
But it's a very liberal, liberal in the classical sense of what liberalism is.
Right.
Idea is like, what matters is you, the individual, and your choices, and your path, and your journey. And, you know, it's like, it's so complicated because those people, most 90% of them, 99% of them, well, they come from a Hasidic family and backward for 700 years.
So the Jews are my favorite amongst all the religions.
I'll let them know.
Please tell them Adam sent you. I've always felt that way, always known it, always seen it. My grandfather, step-grandfather, was Jewish, and he was the sanest, warmest, nicest person in the family.
I'll say one more thing about Hasidic Judaism that most people, I think, don't know, is that what you see now isn't a representation of what Hasidic Judaism, the path that it was supposed to be. What you see now is post-Holocaust Hasidic Judaism, which is there was a gigantic splinter that happened after the Holocaust, which was before the Holocaust, regular Jews, Jews like me, you know, and Hasidic Jews were all intermingled and living together. Secular Jews were in the same society as Hasidic Jews. After the Holocaust, everybody died, and the Hasidic Jews had a reaction. Some of them stayed in the world, like Chabad, the people that do the telethon. Mm-hmm. Those people are still kind of in the world. But the people in my family in New Square and the Satmar, you know, what their response to the Holocaust was like, this world is hopeless, pointless. We can't, there's no point in even being in it anymore. All we can do is build, again, a wall. It's a trauma that they build a wall around. All we can do is build a wall around the last vestiges of our society and just talk to each other, be insular. They were less insular 100 years ago than they are now.
And a provocative, informative, and bizarre note to end on.
Check out my crowd work album.
Crowd surfing, where he talks about the difference between peyos and mezuzah.
Well, this was a lot more in-depth and serious of a conversation than I expected, but I loved it.
Listen, where did the hour go? I'd go for another hour, and I got Gergos calling in 2 minutes. Armenian Jew.
But I will just say the album is an all crowd work album with a concept. So I didn't just say, who are you? What do you do for a living? I asked the crowd very specific questions to elicit stories from them. Like, what's your craziest law enforcement interaction? Or what's your wildest night on drugs? What's your craziest sexual experience? And so it created this awesome. I'm very proud of the album. So check it out.
Good. It's available on all music services and the podcast, The Endless Honeymoon, of course, with Natasha Leggero as well, your wife. She's wonderful and beautiful.
Yeah.
And live shows coming up, Washington, D.C. That's tomorrow through Saturday. And that's at the D.C. Improv and then Telluride Comedy Festival, February 14th through 17th. Moshe, let's do this again because I feel like we barely got. We haven't even got to the nougaty center view.
I love it. Have me back.
Nibbling on the outer chocolatey side of you. All right. We will take a quick break and come back with news right after this.
Adam and Drew, back together again.
Hey, man.
Hey, buddy.
Hey, man. Why should people listen to us every single day, Drew?
Because they complain that we're not around anymore. And where are you? Won't you guys come back? And lo and behold, we've been back the whole time. They need to listen to us every day.
And I think the world needs a nice dose of us.
Yes, it's that time.
Every day.
Yep, every
day. Podcast One and Apple.
It's healthy. It'll improve your soul.
Thank you.
Adam Carolla and Dr. Drew Pinsky, getting it on 5 days a week. The Adam and Drew Show, weekdays on Carolla Digital and Podcast One.
Give me the news with Grad. News with Gino Grad. Breaking viral, all those crazy Trump tweets. Give me news with Gino Grad. Trouble in the Middle East. Celebrity drunk meltdowns. Deep news with Gino Grad.
The news with Gino Grad.
Well, things are really rolling on this Harvey Weinstein trial. So Monday, one of the women at the center of the rape trial took the stand. That's Miriam. She goes by Mimi Haley, a former production assistant on Project Runway, told the jury that the movie mogul forced himself on her orally at his New York City apartment in 2006 and that she was in so much shock she just checked out. Then 2 weeks later, she claimed she had non-consensual intercourse with him in her hotel room. Defense lawyers showed the jury several friendly emails from her to Weinstein after the alleged assault. Attorney Damian Chironis argued that Haley had a, quote, consensual relationship with Mr. Weinstein. And she is one of two accusers who Weinstein has been charged with assaulting. But a couple days ago, Rosie Perez took the stand to testify on behalf of her friend, Annabella Sciorra, who had also taken the stand about how she was raped. But she said, you know, in those days, we didn't think of it as rape. I thought rape was when a stranger jumped out of the bushes. I didn't know it could be after a friendly conversation with an acquaintance.
And how does one set oneself up for forcing oral on a woman?
Yeah, like, that's a
you
power
do
move.
It like I drop my contact. Like, how do we do? How do you physically start that? Yeah,
that's
he's a big man. He doesn't seem that nimble or flexible. Is it? Do you just like start pushing your way down toward the person's waist?
You push her down and push her legs open.
And are guys? Do guys who do that? Do they want to do that, or they think they're going to get the ball rolling this way. Like, you got to realize, like, almost every porn movie has the plot or used to have, like, her going, stop, yeah, stop.
No.
Oh, stop. You know, like, they've seen too much of that.
Right. Maybe. Or this is just one of the many tools in his rapist belt.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we've seen all kinds of
alleged examples. Is this a rape gone wrong, Gina?
This would be a rape gone wrong for sure. Mm. So Perez, a day or two ago, said on behalf of Annabelle Sciorra, I think it was rape. She said, why didn't, you know, they asked, of course, why didn't she go to the police? Sciorra said, because he would destroy me. Weinstein's lawyers asked Perez why she didn't go to the police. And Perez says she wanted to be respectful of her friend. You know, sometimes it's just good to have these reminders, or sometimes we're learning this for the first time. They had a woman, a forensic psychologist named Barbara Ziv, explain on the witness stand that the idea of a woman responding to a sexual assault by screaming and yelling and punching and biting, it happens. It's very rare. She's an expert witness for the prosecution, who also testified in Bill Cosby's sexual assault trial, and dismissed these rape myths that if you didn't fight back, you weren't raped.
Why does she hate men?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Sometimes these women will, you just sort of hover above yourself, and you just sort of stammer home in a stupor, and you try and get on with things, and you don't really know what happened. It's not that if you weren't kicking and biting, you weren't raped.
Well, for sure, if there's any kind of trauma in the past, you seize up.
That's sure.
And the trauma could be lots of different kinds of trauma, but
confrontation of some sort.
Yeah, I mean, well, look, if you were sexually assaulted, abused as a young person, then you completely lock up.
Right.
Like, you just hover above your body. You don't even react. Like, that I learned from Loveline. If somebody just, you know, if somebody, dad mainly, just made you feel like a zero, then you'll have that same thing.
Sure.
You have to have, I hate to say, it's not really high self-esteem. It's a kind of a thing where it's just like, look, Harvey Weinstein could have banged me 1,000 times. I wouldn't have said a word. That's how I grew up. You know, I wasn't physically or sexually abused. I just grew up like, that guy gets to do whatever he wants to you.
Right.
My version of it is like, go crawl under that house and dig a footing with a coffee can. Okay. Like, that's, I just do whatever you told me to do. Like, seriously, I wouldn't do anything if somebody sexually whatevered me, but I'm not quite as desirable as Annabella Sciorra is. Sciorra. Yeah. She's a bit of all right.
Yeah.
So, there needs to be, I can tell you, the percentages are probably right along the lines of percentages of women who are just grown up, just, I hate empowered and strong and all that kind of stuff, but like, I didn't empower Natalia, but Natalia feels like you don't fuck with her and she does what she wants, and if you try to fuck with her, she's going to go off. She's going to sound like a macaw during like mating season, you know? And you have a much better shot at Sonny.
That's probably true.
Pedophiles.
Listen up.
Got your steno pads out. That's their wiring and their upbringing.
Right.
You know, so there's a little nature and nurture in there. But, yeah, people lock up. And also, I think when a guy like, see, here's what these guys have. Bill Cosby, Weinstein, whatever. They have an element of surprise, which is you cannot believe that Bill Cosby has got his hands on your pussy. You're just, your mind is numb. You're 23 and it's going to feel surreal.
Yes.
You know, if you're sitting on a subway and some strange dude does whatever, you immediately react because it's all in this context.
Right.
Harvey Weinstein is doing this thing. You have to process this.
You probably know him pretty well. You're in his hotel room. You've made deals with him.
Right. And that's...
You're right.
That's what's happening. It's like a frozen, like, this is crazy. What's going on?
Exactly. And I'm listening to this podcast series called Chasing Cosby, and it's fascinating. The first episode or two, they talk to Andrea Constand and her mother, and he's so gross. There's not a word for it. He even said, because it's recorded, and he didn't know he was being recorded. And he says to her, you know, in defense of himself, he calls her mom, and says, and mom, she even had an orgasm.
Right.
And then he said, I'm a very sick man. So it's like, this is the Cosby that's talking to the rape victim's mother.
Max Pater, write down an idea for a new podcast that's going to go to the top of the charts. It's a mom's worst nightmare.
Yeah, of course.
We hire an actress.
Right. Ace on the actress.
She tells true stories, you know, about the time her special needs daughter was walking to get froyo in any neighborhood, in any town,
just
USA.
Like yours.
And a primered van pulled up with Cosby and Weinstein driving.
And Epstein.
And Epstein. Oh, we're all in the van. And took them to what they labeled a rape mall. It's a mall for raping.
Jesus.
And that the mom was there. Well, it's all going to be scripted.
Yeah.
And she literally just turned toward the cashier to pay for the froyo and turned around. No sight. Gone.
Oh,
the child was gone. Van, unmarked, no plates.
Windowless.
And they found the body in the river, even though there's no river. But you know what I mean?
Where
we'll
the
just
river
keep
would
going.
Be.
We'll just keep going. Mm-hmm. And then when she'd returned from the coroner's after identifying the body, she walked in on her husband having an affair.
Oh.
And he immediately cut her off. Like that Tyler Perry show, movie, A Diary of a Mad Black Woman, threw all her clothing out onto the street.
Way to exhale.
Was forced out. She started eating chocolate again. She hadn't had chocolate. She'd been soul cycling and not eating chocolate, but she got back onto chocolate.
Uh-huh. Is this the first episode or the series arc?
The pilot. Yeah, yeah. Thank God.
It's establishing.
She had a three-legged puppy that was a rescue, Ernie, that did go. That was the only possession because the new woman had moved into the house.
Quickly.
Okay. And then we're going to capture every single woman on the planet is going to listen to this podcast because that's their
sweet
spot. Their favorite thing. I also have a companion podcast called Quit Listening to Podcasts and Get Back to Fucking Work that I'd like to tack on to that one.
That's
good.
Can't you listen
on the way to work?
Except for these listeners.
Oh, yeah, yeah, not these lists.
Yeah.
Not these, not our list. Sorry.
You guys put a pot of coffee on Hunger Down.
Great.
So People.com reports that Kobe Bryant's items.
Hold on, let's put Trump in the van, too.
Okay.
He grabs them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You want a presidential pin? Come on in the van. That's where they are.
Yep.
Sorry.
Kobe Bryant's items can no longer be found on the Nike website since the passing of the Lakers star on Sunday. But according to the Athletic brand, they sold out. They sold out of all of Bryant's related products, despite reports that they were pulled from the website in order to limit the resell of his merchandise so that items wouldn't later be resold at a higher price. While Bryant, who signed, a $40 million deal with the brand in 2003, used to have tons of Nike-branded merchandise available. If you search Kobe, at least you know at the time of reading this, it only yields Laker-themed Nike gift cards. Everything is gone.
Let's weave in the three chicks from Friends are in another van. And they're chasing the pedophile van.
Oh, that's good.
Right?
Yeah.
So Jennifer Aniston and Phoebe Kudrow. And Kudrow, whatever. Yeah.
Courtney Cox.
They're chasing the other van because we have to weave in a little hope,
a little
too.
Levity.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like one of the chicks from The Office is in there too.
They're still lovable too.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So,
Mindy Kaling.
Write that
Mindy
down.
Put Mindy Kaling in
put
there.
Put Mindy Kaling in there. That's right. Let's get
that's
diverse.
So Adam, this is just for you and me because I love Antiques Roadshow. This guy is getting a lot of press. The PBS show Antiques Roadshow is in the news today after a man brought a Rolex that he purchased in 1974 for $345.97 to find out what it's worth. He brought his unworn Rolex Oyster Cosmograph reference number 6263 in the hopes of learning its value. And, I'm going to spoil it for you. It's worth basically $500,000. Here's what the appraiser had to say about the rare find.
Collectors love this watch because Paul Newman wore it in a movie called Winning. Wasn't this particular model. It did not have the screw-down buttons. The one that Paul Newman wore, currently at auction, those watches are going for approximately $150,000 to $200,000. Your watch is more special.
You
it says Oyster on it.
Yes.
They did that for an extremely short period of time. We refer to that as a Mark II dial. And this particular model, being marked Oyster, is extremely, extremely rare. A watch like this at auction is worth about $400,000.
And he's down.
From no reaction okay? to that?
A woman kind of comes, making sure everyone's okay.
Oh, save it, producer.
Don't fall. I'm not done yet.
He goes on to say that this watch, because he has all the paperwork and all the foil on the back and everything, is wow. actually could go for $500,000 to $700,000.
Yeah. You know, I bought my dad a trumpet. That's how I got rich.
An Oyster trumpet?
We did a man show bit on Antique Roadshow.
I don't remember that.
We've never called it up. It was like fairly funny, but it wasn't, you know, I wasn't in love with it. Like it was a 7 or something like that. So I don't really talk about that much. But what I do remember is there's one thing I learned from the man show, which is like old people cannot act. Like I remember you try to get like old bum guy. Like I remember like old bum guy. Like
oh, yeah.
I like appeared in front of him, like out of puff of smoke. And it's like, we try to say to the guy, hey, You look at the booze bottle, you look at the genie who just landed, you look back at the booze bottle, and you just dump it out and, like, shake your head. And the person was like, genie lands, shakes his head. No, look at the genie, look at the booze bottle, then dump the booze and shake. You're like, never again, never, I'm done with this booze. And be like, genie land, look at the booze. Shake your head at the booze. Look at the genie.
Offer him a drink.
Like, it's like, what you, goddamn, what is, I mean, I remember, you know what used to happen? My wiring, it's like, I remember Tom Stern was doing it, was directing. After about the 26th one, I would go to the person and go, just fucking do what I'm telling you to do. And Tom's like, don't agitate them. I'm like, I'm sorry. You're an adult. You're an actor. You auditioned. Like,
you
we found you. We didn't come to your house and get you. You calling yourself an actor. Just fucking look at the stupid genie and then look at the bottle and shake your head. They can't do it. It's a crazy. The guy, when I did the man show, like antique porn show or whatever it was, one of the guys was a actor from Chips. He was like the guy, the 28-year-old guy who was like back at the headquarters, you know, like Poncherella and Larry Wilcox or whatever,
Baker.
John and Baker and whatever, and the captain. And he was like fifth or sixth down. He'd be like the guy that was always at the Gunther at Central Perk or whatever sure. it is. Like he's the guy who's just kind of always there. What's why he'd come in and say, here's your report. Yeah, that's when he'd walk back. That guy couldn't fucking do what I was telling him to do. Like, I was like, look at the porn book and then look up and look sad or whatever. It's like, it's unbelievable. Mm. And I'll tell you the part that's unbelievable about acting. It's not so much that they can't act. They can't follow instructions. Right. They go, walk in, stop on this mark, then you turn to me. And they just, you see them walk right past you. It's like, it's so prevalent in acting. And then you realize, I don't think this guy could ever act. He just looked good when he was 28 in like the Chip uniform. All right, I've not seen Antique Porn Show in 20 years, but we'll take a look
at it. The Antique Porn Show with vintage porn expert Adam Carolla.
My Uncle Ted left it to me when he died. Don't know if it's worth anything.
Well, let's have a look-see. This is truly an exquisite example of a pre-World War II jack rag. It's definitely authentic. You can see here by the extremely hairy vagina that it's the real McCoy. I'd say a publication in this condition is worth anywhere between $2,000 and $2,500. This is real... wait a minute. Pages 29 through 53 are stuck together. Did you do this? This is worth no more than $5.
That's soil. My heart.
Took like 70 takes to give him the look. It's old timey inflatable doll.
Patchwork.
See how old people can't act?
Attic of your new home?
Yes, the previous owner was this sweet old lady, and we figured it belonged to her.
Well, it looks to be ivory. Chinese, I'd say. Perhaps from the early Dong or Wang dynasty. Oh, yes. Definitely indicative of Dong. Has a very substantial feel to it. Still in working order, I see. A lovely dildo like this would fetch between $1,000 and $1,200 at auction.
All right, we got it. It's all this antique
dildos,
buck plugs, and dildos, and patchwork inflatable dolls, and everything. But the guy, it was the first guy. He was the guy from Chips, and I was trying to get him like, you look, and it's like it's worth $2,500. And I go, did you do this? And you just hang your head in shame. Or he just couldn't do it. He'd smile and go, like,
no. He'd shake his head. Yeah.
Just bad takes, you know. Just kind of like not what you were looking for. They couldn't. He couldn't do it.
A little community theatery.
I just remember thinking, like, God damn, you're actors. Like, and the next guy's like, the old guy's like, and then he goes, ha ha! It's like a huge face and does like the crazy high five. I don't know. The way old people do high fives, the way King Kong would try to swat down biplanes, like, ha! Like, just raise your hand and slap the other guy's hand. Yes, you don't have to go nuts. And that's what I remember from the antique roadshow.
Footnote to that, to your story about the look at the bottle and pouring it out, that old trope, you know what I mean? Like, oh, no more drinking for me. I've seen something too crazy. I know you bemoan the loss of that comedy trope. Last night, watching The Princess and the Frog with Tessa. She's in The Princess and the Frog. 2009, this scene happens. So these two frogs are running through a ball, you know what I mean? They're going across the, everything, crazy things are happening. Go ahead and play the clip.
2009.
2009. Dogs chasing him.
Excuse me. I can't see.
Huh? What?
Right. Dumps out the booze.
Dumps out the booze, yeah.
It's alive. It's alive.
They did that joke a lot. Every single time Bewitched would blink herself into town, she would always land in an alley. Mm-hmm. And there'd always be a bum in the alley, and he'd see it. No one else would see it, and he'd look at the booze bottle. And dump it out. That's all I was trying to do with this person. Couldn't do it. All right, what else you got, Gina Grant?
Well, firefighters in New Jersey shared a video reminding residents why they shouldn't park next to fire hydrants. The Camden, New Jersey, you'll see it now.
Busting some windows and pulling hoses through windows.
Posted a video to Facebook showing what happens when crews had to extinguish the flames at an occupied residence. We're looking at the video now. Two giant smashed windows with the hose going through, broken out by the firefighters so they could run their hose through the car into the house. Fire was extinguished. No injuries were reported. But yeah, don't be a jackass and don't blame anyone but yourself if this happens.
Did they go?
To get to the hydrant.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah, they love it. They're like, look, the axe to the fireman is the gun to the cop. Like, yeah, there's so many shootings. Like, they give me an axe.
It's right
get
there.
Getting itchy trigger finger.
Well, I'm telling you, man, when I used to work at the end of the Tom Johnson's industrial park there, and one day at morning we showed up and his skylight was all busted open, his door was all busted open. It's like, what happened? The dude, it's such a perfect Chatsworth white trash story. Cabinet maker dude who was in the next shop over, got in a blowout with his old lady, went to go sleep in the camper that was in his cabinet. Mm-hmm. It was a truck camper he had like up on jacks and he was like stored there, but that was like his party room or something.
Man,
he went in there, had a few belts. He was a smoker. Dozed off with the cigarette, whole place went on fire. Now, Tom Johnson's unit was not on fire, and they just started busting up. They just came up with the axe and started smacking every door, and we didn't need ours busted open. That's not where the fire was, but that's how roll. Well, you give a 26-year-old guy an axe who's got an axe to swing, and you give a 26-year-old guy a fucking .44, and shit's coming out.
He'll
make use of it.
Yeah.
Yep. I look, when we're at the Man Show and Cousin Sal got hold of a taser, he tased every single person in the building. Now, I mean, that's Cousin Sal, but that's a lot
what
of
else well,
most dudes
do?
Would do that.
Young dudes roll that way. All right, let's do one more.
All right. Well, For those tired of the romantic cliches on Valentine's Day, British Columbia's Hotel Zed has a holiday alternative for you. They are offering a four-hour nooner special on February 14th, which they've done for the past 5 years, and they do quite well. So couples check in at 10 a.m. You check out at 2 p.m. for about $45 American, and you get yourself a little afternoon delight, and you could follow that up with some ping pong in the lounge or the hot tub outside. Meanwhile, the hotel chain is raising the stakes this year by saying that if a couple has a baby 9 months after their stay, they'll win a free stay at the hotel of their choice in the next 18 years.
Yeah. I feel bad for the maids, right?
Yeah.
Like, don't you feel like hot sex bed? You got to come up and clean up. And
take the day off.
Turnover.
Yeah. And then,
turn down service.
And then also what's the occupancy like the next day? Like, hey, we're back to regular business hours.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Come on in, business people.
Well, that night, the reason they probably get them out at 2 is so they can get people checked in at 4.
That's right.
Yeah, you know what I mean? I don't know. That's like too much essence blowing around that,
too much musk.
Too much musk, yeah. You know?
We've been watching a lot of Curb, and we've been rewatching the 9th season, and a lot of talk between J.B. Smoove and Larry David about fuck scent.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
In the guest house.
I am, you know, now that I have, it's so weird. I mean, everything seems like a weird coincidence, but I have these little incidents, and I think something of them, and then sometimes I think, well, that'd be perfect for this, you know, that'd be a funny montage.
Yeah, Mercy Playground.
Yeah.
I smell sex and candy.
Sex and candy.
That would be a perfect vignette for Curb Your Enthusiasm. And I was thinking about it, and I've been thinking about it for like a couple of years, and I never had any contact with Larry David, but now I have contact with him. And so I was thinking about this vignette that I had that would be perfect in his world, and I never
sit next to a costume designer on an airplane.
That's right. Start verbally jousting. So I have no, I'm not going to start pitching ideas to him over the phone or whatever, but you know, fine. But it's always been in my head. So the deal was some version of this. He goes into a coffee shop. He's with his manager and his agent and Jeff or whoever and a couple of guys. The guy, they all get the latte. The guy's doing the thing at the top to make it look like a heart or whatever it is. Somehow, you know, when Larry's is a leaf, when Larry's is presented, it, you know, someone opens the back door and a little wind comes in or something, and his kind of looks like a swastika or something. And he wants to know why is his different than theirs?
That's good.
And I said, it's a perfect vignette.
Yeah.
He obviously has some like pre-existing beef
with the guy
behind the counter. And that was always my idea. Like I've talked about on the air that I went to a coffee place and there was an Asian guy who was like 50. He was behind the counter. And he made a heart and he like presented it to me. And I'm like, fucking combined AIDS is dead. You know what I mean? Like we're a couple of dudes, like save it for the chicks, you know, save it for the believers or something. I'm a fucking old dude who just wants a couple. You don't have to dress it up. You know, you don't have to put a heart. Put the Canadian flag on it or something.
Maple leaf.
Put something other than a heart. Like, what's going on here?
A little intimate.
And I immediately just have this, Curb Your Enthusiasm. Oh, that'd be a funny exchange. Or maybe Larry gets the heart and goes like, Or maybe he gets the heart, but someone else gets something different. He's getting something different. Yeah. He thinks he's being singled out. Whatever. I talked to him a few times on the phone, and I never pitched it to him. But then the season opens. It's all about a coffee shop,
Mocha
and it's all about a guy who doesn't like behind the counter at the coffee shop. And you could pull a clip of this podcast from a year and a half ago where I'm going, Curb Your Enthusiasm, be a funny episode if they blah, blah, blah. So I don't know how anything works, but it's weird, right?
It's in the zeitgeist,
It's all about first episode and the coffee guy. And he's got a beef with the coffee guy. Now he's going to open his own coffee thing. It's like coffee, coffee, coffee.
And here we are.
And formerly, there was no coffee. You know, him doing a play or him doing a movie or whatever. It makes all sense.
Right.
Coffee sounds way out there, but here we are. All right, let's bring it home, Gina Grad.
You got it. I'm Gina Grad, and that's the news.
Stop.
No.
Oh, stop.
Gina Grad. That was the news with Gina Grad.
Simply Safe. No one should feel unsafe at home, period. Fear has no place in the home. That's why Simply Safe is on a mission from day one to protect your home. Do it today. Get free shipping at simplysafe.com. Two eyes in there. Simplysafe.com/Adam. All right. Cleveland Hilarity is coming up February 27th and then off to Indianapolis Helium 28th and 29th of February. Go to AdamCarolla.com. For all you need, my book, I'm Your Emotional Support Animal, you can get at, well, once you get it at Amazon, just click through our website, bookmark us, and enjoy and pre-order. It just helps. And Get Uppity and Shelby America and all those movies now available at Chassis. Two S's and a Y. And until next time, this is Adam Carolla for Moshe Kasher and Gina Grad and Bull Bryan saying mahalo. Quit listening to podcasts and get back to fucking work.
Follow the Adam Carolla Show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. Follow us on Twitter at Adam Carolla. Leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744. Subscribe to Take an E for a weekly dose of inspiration and motivation. The link is at adamcarolla.com. Just click it. While you're there, subscribe to Carolla Classics, hosted by producer Chris, superfan Giovanni, and for tickets and info on everything Adam Carolla, go to adamcarolla.com.